Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. This year marks the 100th anniversary of the ratification of the 19th Amendment, guaranteeing women the right to vote. To commemorate this anniversary, the Helmrich Center for American Research, along with the University of Tulsa's Department of History and Women's and Gender Studies, will host one of America's foremost historians on women's rights history. Sally Rush Wagner was one of the first women to receive a doctorate in women's studies in America and founded one of the country's first college women's studies program at California State University at Sacramento. She currently teaches at Syracuse University and is founder and executive director of the Matilda Jocelyn Gage Foundation and Center for Social Justice Dialogue. She's the author and editor of a number of books, including her latest, released last year, the Women's Suffrage Movement Anthology. She featured prominently in Ken Burns' documentary, Not for Ourselves Alone, his film on the women's suffrage movement. She'll be speaking on the 19th Amendment tomorrow evening at 7 o'clock at the Helmrich Center for American Research, speaking on forgotten champions of women's liberty. She joins us today on Studio Tulsa. Sally Rush Wagner, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks, Rich. Delighted to be with you.
As we approach the 100th anniversary of the passage of the 19th Amendment, what in your mind is most important for Americans to know about that fight for women's suffrage?
I think it's that everything that we know about it is wrong. I think that the typical scenario that we have, the narrative is that it begins in 1848 with the convention in Seneca Falls, and it ends in 1920 when women get the vote. That's wrong.
So what is wrong about that?
Well, first of all, indigenous women have had political voice on this land for at least 1,000 years, and they influenced and gave vision to the women's suffrage movement. Women also voted in the colonies, and the foremothers of the women's suffrage movement knew that, and they said, we're not asking for a new right, we're asking for a restitution of the right that our foremothers had. When property was the qualification, if women had sufficient property in the colonies, they could vote. After the Revolution, when the states formed their constitutions, they wrote into the constitutions that it was illegal for women to vote. So those are just a few of the ways in which that first part of it is wrong. The second part of it is wrong because women had the right to vote assured by the 19th Amendment. That didn't mean that we could vote. The voter suppression laws in place in the southern states, the laws that did not allow women of color and men of color to vote, have kept people and continue today to keep women from voting.
So you're talking about things like, in the old days, poll taxes, literacy requirements, those sorts of things. Those disenfranchised women as much as they did people of color. And yes. I should mention, poor whites, men, too.
Mm-hmm. It did. But the women's suffrage movement made the argument toward the end, give women the right to vote because white women outnumber Negroes and immigrants, and women's suffrage is a way to maintain white, native-born supremacy.
That was also really interesting about the suffrage movement is they made every argument possible, some that to 21st century ears sounds absolutely reprehensible, but it was, again, the goal was to get the vote by whatever means necessary.
It was. And I think that's the way that we can learn from the past. You know, I think that the argument that historians have often given is that, well, it was expediency. They had to practice that in order to win the vote. Well, what if they had, instead of making an alliance with Southern racists, had they had made alliance with African-American men who had the vote and worked to ensure their right to vote, along with immigrant men? Instead of having them be the adversary, they could have been the allies. It would have meant that we would be in a different place right now. Had those voter suppression laws been challenged by the women's suffrage movement, had they made alliance with women like Ida B. Wells, who were working against lynching, how many lives of African-American men might have been saved? I think that at the same time that we celebrate, and they did extraordinary work, that can't be invalidated, But I think it's also a time of accountability. It's a time to look at what did they do right and what did they do wrong, and how can we build on their errors and not repeat them.
I want to go back to the original sort of misconceptions. You said, you know, indigenous people. We know that in many of our indigenous societies, many of them were matriarchal. So that makes complete sense. But the idea that property women voted in the colonies, but it was, you know, it kind of reminds me of Oklahoma state history. You know, Oklahoma was touted as a promised land for African Americans after the Civil War and when it was opened up for settlement. And of course, the first act of the new state is to enact Jim Crow laws. It kind of strikes me as the same way for women in under the Constitution.
Exactly. And those are, I think, the repetitions in history that when we have an occasion like this centennial, that we have an opportunity to go back and really look at our history and evaluate it and say, what parts of this are we going to honor and what parts of this are we going to learn from?
Now, you said that the history we know is pretty much wrong. Given that fact, do you think that the average American has any appreciation for what women went through to acquire the vote?
Well, that's something that we really need to ensure that they do. These women were fearless, and they were fearless even before the women's suffrage movement. With the female anti-slavery societies in the 1830s, a decade before the women's movement really got off the ground in an organized way, these female anti-slavery societies, they learned their organizational skills. They faced down mobs that were threatening to kill them. And they did it with grace, and they did it with extraordinary courage. And so as the women organized for their own rights, they faced some of the same issues. Toward the end, the Women's Party, for example, they picketed the White House. They burned the president in effigy, and they were force-fed when they were arrested. And, you know, they faced the possibility of serious health issues as a result, even death. Women fought very hard to ensure that we would have really a democracy in which there was a voice for everyone, that it was based on the consent of the governed and not just men.
How important are those abolitionist roots towards the suffrage movement once it got going, you know, especially in the 1860s and after the Civil War? How important were those abolitionist roots for the organization?
They were critical up until after the Civil War when the 13th Amendment abolished slavery. The women's movement and the abolition movement joined forces at that point. Up until that point, they'd been working separately but in each other's causes. And they joined formally after the Civil War and worked for universal suffrage. And it could have been possible at that time, but Congress didn't have the courage to push it. And that was when they really divided, Congress divided the women's movement and the abolitionists. And with the 14th Amendment, they wrote into the Constitution the word male in connection with citizenship three times, throwing into question whether women were even citizens. And with the 15th Amendment, they enfranchised African-American men.
You know, it's really interesting. I had a linguist on not too long ago, and it was a conversation about the non-binary pronouns. But one of the things he was talking about is in the 19th century, many of the laws were written with always the masculine pronoun. It was he. And in fact, there was a series of court cases, and it basically said at the time that when we refer to he, if it is a responsibility of the citizen, like to obey laws or to not rob, not to swindle someone or murder someone, it applies to everyone. But when it comes to the privileges of citizenship, it only applies to the males. I thought that was a very interesting way of splitting some legal hairs, but this was the thing the suffragists were tackling on a daily basis.
Yeah, they were. And, you know, one of the things I think, too, is that they weren't working for their rights. They were working initially for personhood, because under the law, the married woman's position was one of legal invisibility. When a woman married and promised to obey her husband, and this really goes back to biblical roots, that canon law becomes the foundation for common law, the two shall become one, and the one is the man. Woman is to be under the authority of man. She is to obey her husband. And that translated into law meant that once a woman married, she was dead in the law. She did not exist. And so it wasn't just that they didn't have rights. Of course, if you don't exist legally, you can't vote. You can't own property. You have no rights to your children. Husbands could will away unborn children. And that's the degree to which, and you know, he might die writing his will. This is who the child should go to. He dies. The mother gives birth to the child, and the child is taken away from her and given to its rightful owner, the one that the husband assigned as the owner of the child and the guardian. And, you know, so for women, the push to just be recognized as legal entities was really the deeper question. The vote was one of the issues, but at the beginning of the women's movement, it wasn't the only one.
It was everything from zero property rights, zero personhood rights, I guess.
Mm-hmm. And the right to be safe in their person. Husbands had the right to beat their wives. They had the legal right to rape their wives because these were non-entities, you know, and the wife had the responsibility to obey the husband. And if she didn't obey him, he had the right to enforce that obedience. One of the Supreme Courts in the South said, we can't interrupt this domestic tranquility, that unless the husband has inflicted permanent damage, we don't want to upset their language was the domestic tranquility of the home, which rested on male power and authority.
Yeah. Right. It's sort of like the first right of privacy, but it's all geared towards male domination.
Yeah. You know, they raised all the issues in the 1850s, the beginning of the women's rights movement. They raised almost all the issues that we're raising today. Violence against women, equal pay for equal work was an old adage by 1850. You know, women made half the wages then that men made. 150 years later, we're making a little over 75. We got to work a little quicker to get pay equity in this country, I think. And they were working for reproductive justice. Some of the women took that on as an issue. So, you know, nothing is new. They just, as the movement became more conservative, they focused exclusively on the vote. And that's the part of the movement that we learn most about.
My guest today is Sally Rush Wagner. She's an educator. She teaches at Syracuse University, and she's the founder and executive director of the Matilda Jocelyn Gage Foundation and Center for Social Justice Dialogue. She's been a longtime women's history educator, and she will be speaking at a 19th Amendment Centennial Commemoration event this Friday evening at 7 o'clock at the Helmerich Center for American Research, talking about the forgotten champions of women's liberty, and she has a new book of edited volume called The Women's Suffrage Movement. And I think you're going to talk about some of the subjects of that book. For example, are indigenous peoples' roots in looking for equality and women's liberty? And specifically, I'm not going to use their word for their tribe as how we understand it today, is the Iroquois. Tell us a little bit about the Iroquois. And because when you think about it, the Iroquois' ancestral lands is sort of the hotbed of the suffrage movement, upstate New York.
Absolutely. And in looking at some of the major women in the women's suffrage movement, Lucretia Mott, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, Matilda Jocelyn Gage, Stanton and Gage were really the theoreticians of the women's movement. And they all knew Haudenosaunee women. And they knew these women who had political voice and had continue to have political voice and continue to have it today. The structure of the Confederacy and each of the nations in the Confederacy is that the clan mothers have really the political responsibility. It's a balance. The clan mothers, you know, they raise the sons. They know who is going to watch out for the needs of everyone. And the decisions have to be made for the seventh generation. How will this decision affect seven generations from now? you make decisions based on that, and you're going to be a little more careful of the land than we are and the resources of nature that that sustain us. But the clan mothers nominate, hold in office, and remove, if necessary, the chief that represents the clan. It's an authority they have today. They've had it for 1,000 years. The basic rules for them deciding are, there's someone who would be a good, who's a good family man, someone who is really sensitive to other people's needs, who has a thick skin and can handle criticism, who has not committed a murder or a theft, or has never committed any, you know, economic misdealings, and has never abused a woman. Not a bad decision-making process, I would say, but they continue that process today. And these women who had no political voice and actually no personhood looked at these women who had absolute control of their bodies, who really were responsible for the economy because they were the agriculturalists. These women who had the final decision in war and peace, you know, they're looking at this and it's looking pretty good. And given the position that the white women, the suffragists are coming from, they're looking at these indigenous women and realizing, you know what, it's possible to have a different position. It's possible that we structure our society differently. They saw a vision of what equality looked like and what freedom looked like, and they were inspired.
Now, it's interesting, some of the more conservative members of the suffragette movement maybe looked at that model because their reason for women getting the vote, as they thought of it, as being a moderating force on men who would make the decisions. Was that an influence?
You know, I think there were a number of different influences. That's one I hadn't really thought about and one that I'll pursue. But I think that if you're living in a state of real oppression and you're told that it's the natural condition, physiologically and mentally, you're inferior to men. You're the clinging vine to the mighty oak. You know, God has decreed that you are to be under the authority of man. You're going up against a lot of your culture if you are challenging any of that. And I think seeing women who lived in a very, very different way and seeing them up close, that gave them a sense that their lives could be different. I think that's the basis of that influence.
Now, another person I'm sure you're going to talk about is the person that you've worked very hard to get her due as one of the pioneers of women's liberty, and that would be Matilda Joslyn Gage. She had a very different view. She was looking, I mean, she was considered a radical in the movement. She believed full on that women were absolutely equal to men, and for that fact alone, they deserved the vote and far much more.
Yes. And, you know, one thing that's really interesting about Gage is that in 1893, she is arrested for voting. She votes in a school board election, and she votes for a state position, school superintendent. She's pushing the envelope. They've won the right to vote, and she's in part of that process in New York State to get the vote for women in school board elections, the local ones. But she pushes the envelope and votes for a state position, and she's arrested. And the same year, it goes to court, and, you know, she loses. She never spends time in jail, but she's pushed the envelope. But the same time, she is given an honorary adoption into the Wolf Clan of the Mohawk Nation, and she actually says to her daughter, I am being considered for a position on the Council of Matrons, which would have given her a say in the choosing of the chief, because all the decisions are made by consensus. The clan mother nominates, and then it goes to the entire clan, and all the women and the men have a say in it. Is this going to, it's not representative democracy, it's pure democracy. And so she is potentially going to have a voice in this nation to which she's been given an honorary adoption at the same time that she is arrested for exercising a political voice in her own nation. And I think that, pretty extraordinary set of events.
She was one of the theoreticians of the movement. What sort of guided her philosophy in thinking this, what was then a radical belief in the 19th century, that women were absolutely equal to men?
I think that her book, Woman, Church, and State, which is online and searchable, she lays out the process historically by which women have been oppressed in the West. And she really lays it at the foot of religion and the Eve story, and woman is to, because of the sin of Eve, to be under the authority of man. And that continues through the Bible through to St. Paul, with women being told to be obedient to men. And she says that is the foundation for woman's oppression. And I think that position of being critical of her own spiritual tradition allows her to be open to looking at other traditions. You know, this is at a time when the basic Christian position was that Indians were savages, that they had they needed to be brought to God. They needed to be missionized and taught the true belief. And so I think that if you have that position, you're not going to see the value of the indigenous cultures. If you think that if you care about them, you need to destroy what their spiritual underpinnings are. And so I think that her ability to see that, interestingly, Lucretia Mott also was able to see that, and so was Elizabeth Cady Stanton. My book, the anthology, The Women's Suffrage Movement, begins with those women writing about, and other women, other suffragists writing about, the superior position of indigenous women.
Do you think that belief of the in the society, the indigenous societies, and how they treated women sort of led to her falling out of favor once we did get the vote? Because as you well know, there was sort of a reordering of history after the 19th Amendment passes. We remember Susan B. Anthony. For a long time, we didn't remember Elizabeth Cady Stanton. We less remember people like Matilda Joslyn Gage and Lucretia Mott. Do you think that that idea of, okay, you get the vote, but the rest of your ideas, we want to cover those up?
Yes, I absolutely. I think she becomes an embarrassment because she is so opinionated and her ideas are so challenging to the status quo that I think the later suffrage movement wants to appear conservative, wants to appear non-threatening, and Gage is, she's definitely not that. And so, especially when they bring in the Women's Christian Temperance Union into the suffrage movement, and they want to not only outlaw alcohol and the use of it in the country, they want to destroy the wall of separation of church and state and create a Christian nation. That's what their goals. And Gage says that's the biggest danger of the hour. If we lose religious liberty in this country, it's not going to matter who votes. If we become, a nation of conservative Christianity, which was the direction they were pushing, we no longer have freedom of religion. The founding fathers saying that's the basis of all other freedoms. So she becomes increasingly at odds with and drops out of the organized women's movement. She actually forms her own organization to fight for religious freedom and the separation of church and state.
My guest today is Sally Rush Wagner. She will be speaking on the 19th Amendment Centennial Commemoration. She'll be speaking at Friday evening at 7 o'clock at the Helmrich Center for American Research on the Forgotten Champions of Women's Liberty. We've talked about some of those forgotten champions, but if there was one other person that you could push out there, somebody Americans ought to learn about in the fight for suffrage and the continuing battle for universal suffrage, because we think we have universal suffrage, but there are still suffrage battles being fought today.
Oh, I think one of the women that just intrigued me is Mary Ann Shad Carey. She was the first She was the first African-American woman to edit a newspaper on the North American continent. She went to Canada, which, you know, is where African-Americans had to go for freedom after the passage of the Fugitive Slave Act. She comes back to the United States to recruit African-American soldiers and becomes a military recruiter during the Civil War. She goes on to get her law degree. She's involved in the suffrage movement, and she's also involved in African-American rights. She's an absolutely fascinating woman.
We'll talk a little bit about that push for true universal suffrage. Our battles over suffrages continue even in the 21st century, don't they?
Yes. And I think that's one of the things that we can look at in terms of the ongoing work for creating democracy. I think we tend to think of, well, democracy, been there, done that. We got it all figured out. It's in place. Well, you know, until every single person has an equal voice, we don't have democracy. And I think the founding mothers and their allies, the males who worked for women's suffrage and women's rights, I think they point us in the direction that it really is an ongoing struggle. And that once you attain your liberty, you can't just assume that it's a given. It's an ongoing fight to maintain democracy. And I think we're facing that today when the rule of law is really being challenged. Is there really punishment for people who have broken the law? If we don't have that, we don't have a democracy either. So I think we still have our work to do. And our suffragist foremothers can give us the courage and the vision to move forward.
It sounds like your dog seconds that opinion. Well, you know, it's interesting. Suffrage was added to the Constitution in the 19th Amendment in 1920. It took 60 years for women to vote in equal measure to men till the 1980s. And of course, today now more women than men vote. But you can see it is a long evolution to going from maybe even getting the right to exercising that right.
Yes. And to protecting it, to continue to protect it against the voter suppression laws and acts that keep people from voting.
Sally Rush Wagner, we look forward to your appearance here in Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Well, thank you, Rich. It's been a delightful conversation.
Sally Rush Wagner is the founder and executive director of the Matilda Jocelyn Gage Foundation and Center for Social Justice Dialogue and teaches at Syracuse University. She's one of America's foremost historians on the history of women's rights. She'll be speaking tomorrow evening in a 19th Amendment Centennial Commemoration event at the Helmrich Center for American Research. That lecture is free to the public. She'll be speaking on Forgotten Champions of Women's Liberty. She's also the author of The Women's Suffrage Movement, an anthology. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.